Welcome to panel 4313, Millennials and Boomers. Since there are so many people here on the panel, and since it's such a good topic, we're just going to start really quick with name introductions. So to my right is Del Garcia, and joining us as well is Rehan Survey, and then Chris Borland, and going down to Mara Save. And on the end is Joe Sexton. And so the topic, Millennials and Boomers, I was told it was actually called Millennials versus Boomers, but we're going to be as genteel as we can.
No. I come here for 3 years, and I've always felt that there was just something missing. And like a fucking fist fight. That's the missing thing. Let's do it.
I like
my chances against Chris. He beat me in the NFL, and I tied.
Exactly. So, very quickly, I said it would be nicest to get a little bit of quick information from each one in succession. Where you grew up, parents' occupation, and then biggest gripe, if there is one, with other generation. Del, do you want to start us off?
What happened to our band?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And your favorite band growing up, please. This could be the source of the
So, my name is Deliana Garcia, and I go by Del because Deliana is often a mouthful for people. I grew up in El Paso, Texas. My father was a carpet layer. And my mother was an office worker until she was in her 40s, and then she went to nursing school. And then she went on to become a nurse practitioner, and then she went on in her 60s to get a master's in health administration. My favorite band when I was growing up was Cream.
There you go. And Del, did you have a gripe with any other generation?
You know, other generations. My mother, but younger, no. I mean, my sense is that it has been a total advantage for me to have the opportunity to work with. I mean, I have people in my office so young that you can add their ages together, and I'm still older, and it's really wonderful.
There you go, Rehan.
Cool. So hi there, I'm Rehan Survey. I'm from South Africa, Cape Town. And I was added to the panel to kind of balance out this battle that Joe talks about because we only had two millennials going. But given my history is very passionate about equality, coming from South Africa and the history of apartheid throughout much of the 20th century, my parents, I think I might have to go back one more generation in order to be to the boomers because they are still fairly young. but in terms of what they do, my mom's a PhD student currently at the University of Pretoria, and my father is a investments holdings company owner in South Africa. And in terms of one pet peeve, I guess, with the old generation is that I feel like there's just sometimes a lack of effort to be able to come to terms with the millennials. And I mean that in the way that it's so often that the assumption is immediately that, oh, it's because you're a millennial or something like that. There's no time taken to explain or to relate across the generations.
Your favorite band?
Favorite band, not so much band, but rapper, Kendrick Lamar.
How many boomers here listen to Kendrick Lamar? Chris Borland, I'm originally from Dayton, Ohio. My father is a financial advisor and CPA. My mother, in addition to being a homemaker and raising seven kids, taught part-time at a culinary school. Favorite band, Wilco. So I'm kind of between, I think, generations a little bit.
It's not Billy Bragg.
Yeah, yeah. And gripe with boomers. I'm probably, again, like with the band between Rohan and Del, not entirely gripeless, but I don't think it's unique to millennials and boomers. I feel like every generation feels like the next is lazy, and the previous generation had it. They had to go uphill both ways through the snow, and this just repeats itself every generation. And so, yeah, there's that same thing that I've experienced. I think we all have, but I don't know that it's unique to these two generations in particular.
Well, to quote Wilco, right, every generation thinks it's the worst, every generation thinks it's the end of the world.
I was going to use that later, I wrote that down.
Hello, I'm Mara and I'm an undergrad student at Babson College. I'm a sophomore student. My parents, they are not baby boomers either, but my mother is a mathematics professor and my father an economist. My favorite band is Kings of Leon. And in terms of clash between these two generations, so I grew up in Romania, which is a post-communist country in Eastern Europe, and baby boomers spent a significant part of their lives under the communism. So they've grown up to embrace certainty, to embrace conformity. They are expecting that once they were out of school, they were given a place to live and a basic job that they needed. Everything, the average was encouraged more than it was the American dream type of mentality. Do your best, change the world. There was nothing like this. And now we have the millennials in my country who want to change the world, who are active, more active than any of the previous generations, who are entrepreneurial, who want to create their own businesses and launch things within the society. And there is this clash between mentalities, especially given that the professors, most of the professors in the public education system, are baby boomers. So they teach us, but we have a completely different mentality. And they are showing empathy, we are showing empathy, so it's not too bad, but it's definitely a big difference, especially under the historical background that we have in Eastern Europe.
Joe? Hi, I'm Joe Sexton. Born, raised, I still live in Brooklyn, and I used to say I'm never fucking leaving, but you can now buy artisanal pickles in Brooklyn. That may ultimately drive me out. My dad was born in Madison, Wisconsin, went on to become a lawyer, Korean War veteran. My mom was a radical Catholic feminist who didn't get married until she was 30, but then got busy and then had 7 kids, which ultimately pushed her towards her ultimate twist of her career, which was at the age of 65, went to the seminary and got her Master's of Divinity. Not permitted in the Catholic Church to actually be a priest, she found a way nonetheless to go to an Episcopal seminary and get her Master's of Divinity and serve women in her life accordingly. What was it, Big Band or Ben? Oh, well, let me start with the gripes first. Because it's a long podcast. I think I had a gripe with everyone. That led to some beatings at home, getting kicked out of high school, a couple of arrests when I came here to see you, and they said goodbye to me after 2 years. I was a pretty, I was a generalist in the world of gripes. My favorite band was The Clash.
There you go.
Go figure.
Well, it kind of brings up this question of the role of parents as models to live up to or to rebel against, right, with every generation. If that was something that you wanted to do or if it was something that you wanted to be against. And so thinking about this just real quickly, the boomer generation was raised by what is now termed the greatest generation. And so what the question that I kind of was asking you myself, and I'll ask you, was that greatest generation was kind of infamous for being, I don't want to talk about it, whatever they did. And yet this generation wants to talk about everything with everyone. And so this role of the parents and then this role of rebellion, was that something that you found that you were drawn towards, that you wanted to emulate, or was it something that you wanted to rebel against?
So I think my parents were very interesting in that my dad was about 14, 15 years older than my mother. So he served in World War II and my mother was a child. And so their experience of that sort of defining period of time was really quite different. So I think they had their own intergenerational struggle. And really, I didn't want to talk to either one of them. So it was not so much that they didn't want to talk about it. It just, there was so much conflict that really after a point there was really, let's just not go there. But to say that millennials want to talk about everything, I have a son who's a millennial, and I always categorize our relationship as need to know, and I don't need to know.
Agreed, so much so.
Ron, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So for me, I think I'm so closed up. Like, I would never want to talk about everything to my parents, but to other people, for sure. So in terms of, like, the relationship with my parents, it was very much, like, you know, they were very, like, what they did in high school and was study, go to the library, and go in the nighttime, go and work against the anti-apartheid struggle movement, work with it, sorry. And so for them to see me, you know, doing things like music, going out and playing sports for most of my life, and then hardly studying, is, like, very challenging. And it's something that they didn't necessarily understand in the beginning. But once you start to realize that, you know, education is about more than just studying, and it's about developing that cultural side, the society side, the sporting side, and the academic side, then they start to realize that this is actually something that's much more beneficial.
I think a point of rebellion for me growing up was religion. My parents were fairly conservative. My dad actually wanted to be a Jesuit priest in high school. I got out of the dogma game pretty early. I can remember in second grade learning transubstantiation. And for those of you that don't know, that's the host becomes the actual body and blood of Christ. And I couldn't have articulated it, but to me in second grade, that just sounded like cannibalism. but my parents were churchgoers and believed in it fairly dogmatically, at least my mom. And from a very young age with all of us, I'm one of seven, like I'd mentioned, was just a point of conflict. And I think a generational gap. Millennials are without a doubt, and I think this is a global trend, more secular than the previous generation. So yeah, that's been the main thing. Other than that, though, I mean, it was tremendous respect for their beliefs, and they abided by them. So it wasn't a fundamental hatred, or I was trying to figure it out more on my own than just take their word for it or the church's word for it.
Yeah, so in my personal case, there's not been much rebellion so far between me and my parents. I used to share everything with them, but I think there's, in my country, there's been a rebellion between the systems as we moved from communism to the current system. So there has been a general rebellion against the past. I want to go a bit in more details in the baby boomers, how they have grown up under the communism system. I talked to my grandparents and I've done research on it. And if you think about the media, the movies were all about their leaders and the parties and the rulers. Literature, all the poets that had previously educated the people from the country, poetry is a big thing in Romania, had been banished. So only new poets which were writing about the leaders of the country were being allowed, and no one had heard about these new poets. There was a culture of mediocrity being encouraged. The church was being banished. There was no moral values allowed to be discussed in society, in school, apart from praising the leaders. That's about the media and the community. If you go into education, if you're the child of a priest, you were not allowed to get into school. If your parents had land, you were not allowed to go into school because you were rich. So the average individual was encouraged. You had to be average in order to get access to education. Afterwards, if you go into the community, the leaders of the country, the government had infiltrated their own people within diverse organizations, jobs, to identify those who speak badly of the government. And if you didn't know who those people were, they were your fellows, your friends, you didn't know who those were. They were like spies. So there was this continuous lack of trust. So that's kind of the system in which they have grown up. And communism, so I'm not saying it's good or bad. That was their reality. That's what happened. And communism got down in Romania in 1989. And it was very extreme because we were the only country which killed their their company, the Ceausescu. So there was a lot of rebellion between the next generations that came afterwards. So rebellion was, in general, systemic at the national level, not only at a personal, familial level, between the baby boomers' mentality and approach and general context in which they've grown up and the next generations. And also now, there's still this stigma towards their mentality, but there's a lot more empathy and more trying to understand because that was their reality. But that's kind of how rebellion is in our country from a historical background.
I raised two millennials, and I was so thoroughly disappointed in them. At age 51, I wanted to try again, so I had twin girls at 51. So they're 7. So we could have a good game at the end about, you know, what would we call that generation? Right now, it's a fucking nightmare. I think the question when asked 10 minutes ago was about this generation, millennials' capacity for communicating or sharing. I actually think that the proposition that they want to share all is actually not right. I think they're pretty sophisticated and savvy about what they want to share and how they want to share it. What has impressed me most, I actually kind of care for my first two girls. One is in South Korea, so I'm hoping she comes back alive. And the other one, it gets married in September. And then the great peace accords between boomers and millennials, I am actually going to be the officiant at her wedding. But one of the things that has impressed me most about them is how they communicate with each other. Mm. You know, when I reflect back on my childhood and my generation, I think it cuts across gender. Girls, I think, by and large, are better communicators than boys. But I do think they're distinctively gifted at genuine communication with each other, and the bonds that have been connected, that have been made, and the sort of joint commitments that they've set themselves to are enormously impressive and, quite frankly, shame me.
Well, it brings up the question to me about heroes in regards to your idols growing up. And the difference in regards to the idols that were in your media during your growing up, who you wanted to aspire to, but then your own personal aspiration in regards to a role model.
You know, as a Mexican kid growing up in El Paso, which was really pretty provincial, I can't think of heroes particularly, and when I came away to college, I was part of the 1% minority student population that was allowed to enroll at UT Austin on the flagship campus, and so it was, I didn't have a lot of role models there either. You know, historical heroes, I mean, you know, Kennedy was killed when I was in the second grade. His brother was killed when I was still in grade school. You know, so it's the development and the recollection of those heroes, I guess, is the honest truth, I don't really recall. I mean, my heroes now are much more current. One hero that I do have is I'm Jewish, but I got sent to a convent school by my mother. And that I was educated by Jesuits. And there was a Jesuit priest, he wore the long dress and smoked. And he taught world religion. And I remember he was always, he didn't care what you believed, but you had to be able to state it clearly, cite your sources, and defend it. And so it was some element of scripture, and I can't tell you what it was, but he kept saying, you know, and so what is Jesus saying here? And I was like wandering all over the place. And he finally, you know, he tried twice. And then finally he stopped and he goes, what's the serious point? And I said, Jesus is admonishing us to be better Jews. And he took a hit off with his cigarette and he went, and that was the end of that.
Truth to power.
Yeah. I'll take this one. So for me, there was, I've always had two obvious role models growing up in South Africa and growing up in fortunate to have both parents. But my father was one of them, my mother too. But my father and Nelson Mandela. So I was very fortunate to be able to meet Nelson Mandela on a few occasions. My dad, before he went into business, was the doctor to Nelson Mandela after he came out of Robben Island, after serving 27 years there. And one of the things that has stayed with me throughout my life is his ability to not only have an energy to relate to people, but to go into every conversation with the thought in mind that when you speak to someone, if you speak to them in a language you understand, you speak to their mind. But if you speak to someone in the language that is their own, you speak to their heart. And that has stayed with me throughout my entire life.
One of my role models growing up was Pat Tillman. He was a professional football player, one of the best safeties in the league. He quit after 9/11 to join the Army, was killed. There's a great John Krakauer book about his journey. I think Pat's legacy gets really flattened and he gets painted as this all-American hero. I was drawn to him because he was something of a contrarian. He used to ride his bike to camp, to fall practice for football, never bought into the NFL lifestyle, stayed true to his roots and was genuine. I grew up as a kid absolutely loving sports. My father was a college football player. There's lots of athletes I imitated on the field, but never bought in entirely to that archetype. And I admired Tillman for breaking the mold. I think that's something that's common with millennials now, is that we're seeing in this era of radical transparency that some of these archetypes are antiquated and there's new ways to do things. So for me, he was one of the early people to really do that in my chosen profession of football.
So, for me, one of my main role models has been Richard Branson. And I think it's interesting because as you go from generation to generation, usually the role models are within your community because you don't have access to, for instance, in my grandparents' case, they didn't have access to internet to hear about the incredible accomplishments of other people from the opposite part of the globe. So they had role models which were closer to them, closer to the community. They could interact with them. And my role model is Richard Branson, who I've never met. Maybe I'll never meet. He doesn't even know who I am. And I often tend to think, is it good to have role models close with you within your community, or is it better to have them through the internet in opposite parts of the world? And another idea, because I was thinking between the role models of baby boomers and those of the millennials, we tend to set up being able to find about all these incredible achievements of people from all over the world often makes you undermine yourself, think, oh my goodness, what am I doing in comparison with them? Often you tend to stop enjoying the little things in life because you see all these incredible rich people on the internet and media is talking about, and you say, oh, that's the life, it's not how life is for me. So that gets me thinking. I think, yeah, the baby boomers, the definition of a role model for the baby boomer is greatly different from the one for the millennials. And I think it's a bit better for the baby boomers from this perspective. It has changed a lot. It's interesting. And it, yeah.
So, having heroes. As I've gotten older, it's a more perilous thing than one would wish. You have a hero and you put yourself at some risk of, you know, being disappointed or betrayed somehow. And, you know, just to pick up on Chris's hero, through no fault of his own, he gets misused as a hero by the U.S. government and the Department of Defense. He dies in Afghanistan. He dies in what the Army and the military first put out as a heroic, you know, fight to the death with the Taliban. And he wound up having been killed by friendly fire, and they suppressed that news. and his family and others finally pushed for the truth to come out, and it did. And again, that does nothing to Pat's legacy. If anything, maybe enriches it. But you have a hero, your personal risk, and the risk of having that hero misused. Growing up in Brooklyn, I mean, I spent my early career as a sports writer, and it's not surprising that you know, sports figures became some number of my heroes, and there's nothing more perilous than having sports heroes. When I went on to become a sports writer, and you actually interact and live and with these athletes day in and day out, it kills a fan. But my dad was a pretty progressive guy. He was a huge Muhammad Ali fan, and you know, in white, Irish, Italian, ethnic Brooklyn in 1970, when Ali fought Frazier for the first time, I lived in a Frazier neighborhood. Right, Frazier was the white man's fighter, and Ali was the black man's fighter. And you know, I fell head over heels for Muhammad Ali, and for a long time. And for a long time, you know, I felt quite good about it. And then I was asked, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, to write a piece for the Times, New York Times, which is where I worked, because a new documentary had come out about the third Ali Frazier fight. And so, in an honest effort to write something thoughtful or whatever, I went back and read again a more complete picture of Ali, and was crushed. Again, doesn't make his multiple, talents and gifts and contributions vanish, but it was a humbling experience. So, pick your heroes at your peril.
Absolutely. I feel like I should stop here and just let you know that we're going to be going with the old-fashioned method for questions. So Mark will have note cards to pass out, and you can pass them up to here, and I can read them for you.
Can I propose something?
Yeah.
Just because it can sometimes become, but we're in and out place. Why don't people just stand up and ask their questions?
Yeah, and I can repeat it as well.
I just think it'll be more efficient.
Yeah,
and we're all about efficiency.
What's that?
We're all about efficiency.
Yeah, because the fucking millennials are lazy.
It's a green movement.
They're not going to get that. Where did that good idea come from?
And since there are so many people in the audience, let's start with questions.
I'll jump in quickly because I do think, and I think this was said earlier, right? When I saw the panel title, and they come as a surprise to many of us, I winced a little bit because I was like, oh, it's one more way we can divide ourselves.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Lord knows, Lord have mercy, we could use with less division. So I think I'm picking up on your spirit, which is, you know, these kind of, you know, categories and defining them or whatever are extremely limiting and mostly unfair and not particularly healthy. As I was scrambling to actually say something coherent or whatever, let me look up what are the supposed qualities of millennials. And you can come across, well, they're lazy, they're entitled, they're special, they're sheltered, they're confident, they're team-oriented, they're conventional, they're pressured, and they're achieving. And not a bad mixed bag. But then I came across, and then there's disagreement. Somebody else has another list of what millennials are supposed to be. But the one shared quality that came up in the list I quickly Googled or whatever was, at least allegedly, a talent for tolerance. Mm-hmm. And if nothing else, if they possess nothing else,
yes,
and they do nothing else, and they contribute nothing.
Increasing tolerance.
Yes, that's enough. God bless them.
And the only thing
thing I would add is that I think if you grew up that you were going to have one job or you were going to stay in one industry and that place was going to be solid for you and you were going to contribute and there was this agreement, there was a contract between you and the working world, and that doesn't exist anymore, but I think that that mindset has really been hard to shake. And it's been an education for me to see people really make a decision about the kind of work that they want to do, test drive it, go, you know what, that was not as interesting as I thought it was going to be, and be willing to move elsewhere. So I think, and the other piece is that I think, it's my impression, is that schools are not very good at teaching critical thinking. And so then you have people who are put in work positions, because that's my only experience other than my son, where they're being asked to critically analyze and then provide you with a whole variety of things. And they're developing that talent as you're asking them to produce the work. And I think that that's also a real problem.
I'd like to add on to what Joe said as well. You know, how many differences are there actually between baby boomers and millennials? Because fundamentally, we are young, but baby boomers were young, right? They were young. Some would say they still are young, but they were young. And when you think about it, in terms of this idea of, you know, what do you think your parents did? Like, they also had a hard time in school sometimes. They also went out. They also had sex. Like, what's the difference between what your parents did and what you are doing at the moment? And it might be like a hard thing to think about, but there's so much to relate to. There's so many stories that can be shared. There's so much common ground that just gets overlooked over and over again. So just think about that the next time you're having this conversation. Like, think about the similarities instead of immediately thinking about the differences.
Absolutely. There was a comment just by the audience that if we could speak into the microphone.
Oh, yeah, sure. Did everyone hear me?
Yeah. Well, one simple point to Barbara Lou's question. Hi, Barbara Lou. Boomers raised millennials, so I think it's strange to be so critical of something you're responsible for.
What are the age range?
The age range of boomers and millennials?
Boomers are older than 64.
Yeah, I think so.
1965 is the end of the boomers.
I think millennials like 1990, yeah, 1990, like around 1992
to 94,
like somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
89.
All right, here comes the fist part.
Here we go.
You were waiting for this.
So this is a question from a student. What value principle do you want your opposing generation to adopt?
I attended a panel yesterday about tech run wild, and there's been a few of those this week, and they all kind of end the same way. You know, you'll have an hour and a half of these brilliant people talking about artificial intelligence and innovation and disruption, and they all end with, we don't know what's going to happen next, and it's kind of frightening. At the end of the panel, the man sitting next to me leans over and whispered, I'm so glad I'm old. And so I would love to see boomers empathize with millennials' seeming meandering, because delaying life a little bit, figuring things out, I actually think it's an appropriate way to navigate a really rapidly changing world. And it's not laziness. I think it's wise. I think it's skillful.
And when I I mean, my son and I have always been alone, so that it really has been a close relationship. But how many of you remember Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? And the scene in the library where the father is admonishing Sidney Poitier, and he turns around and goes, listen, old man, I don't owe you anything. And I have always told my son, you don't owe me anything. This was my gig, and I was really excited. But the number of people who want to tell my son that he does need to do something because he owes me something makes me crazy. So I think that that is been a really important lesson for me. The meandering, you know, my son wants to be an actor. I'm gonna have to work till I'm 90. But he's not gonna do his life the way I have done it. And what I recommend to anyone that they be as driven as I was, and is crazy. No. So I'm learning from him. It's like I'm trying to be really zen about, okay, you want to dress up like the Joker with white face and green hair? Perfect, let's go.
So she grows up, she graduates from high school early, she goes to Argentina, she learns Spanish, she comes back, she goes off to Reed College, she gets a degree, she's thinking about law school, she gets on a plane to Southeast Asia, she works in Thailand, she gets a job teaching Muslim kindergartners, she writes a report for the Crown Prince of Thailand. She hops on a plane to Vietnam because that sounded interesting. She falls in love with a Korean fella there who wants to open a dessert shop in Hanoi. And so she lives above the dessert shop in Hanoi while getting a job as a copy editor at the English language national paper. She teaches herself photography. She freelances writing. She decides, I want to go to graduate school. And so she applies to graduate school in Korea and studies international security. Clever child that she is, she says, oh, they have a semester abroad program from Korea. And she went to Paris for 6 months studying at some highfalutin political theory school. She returns, she's getting her degree in Korea. She's facing down the prospect of being nuked. She's been accepted at Georgetown Law. She's been given half a scholarship at Georgetown Law, and she is paralyzed with fear about taking on the debt. So she's my second child, and I think the world of her. And she really is a millennial in all the best. There's, the globe feels so accessible in ways that for us were unfathomable. You know, the idea that you could, you know, when Vietnam for us, right, it was a war, it was like on another fucking planet, you know, and she hops on the plane and goes and picks up the language. You know, they take my breath away. I'm so impressed by them. But they're also, right, saddled with, you know, the anxiety, the financial specter of taking on. Why should a child like that, she's my child and I'm fond of her and I don't want to throw a pity party, but why should a child who's done all that and who's earned that, possibly turn down a law degree because she just fears being in debt? And that sums up part of the millennial's dilemma as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that was actually the next question, which was, how can millennials and boomers engage in a conversation about public policy regarding our financial and environmental future? I.e., boomers have incentives to get things now. Millennials have incentives to save for later. So, I mean, is there something in regards to just growing up in Eastern Europe as well that might be a different perspective in regards to that, in regards to then coming to the United States and seeing that?
So I definitely agree with this concept of instant gratification that we now get from social media and from our phones. Anything happens instantly. And I think that's coming against us many, many times in our careers, because usually it's not that easy. It's not that things take time. But I think from a financial perspective, from my knowledge, which is not very good with regards to this topic, I don't think that millennials don't think in terms of long term. As you just gave us an example about your brother and the fear to take on debt, and we see more and more college students opting for other kinds of education because college price here in the US is incredibly expensive. So I think millennials, short-term satisfaction applies from this perspective. I'm not sure what the other panelists think.
I mean, does it, I mean, does that also tie into identity, right? So does, do we need to have that job to then have our particular identity? I mean, it seems like that's constantly what the breaking point is. You know, if I become the lawyer, then I'm just a lawyer. You know, and then if I constantly go to the snack bar, I can be all these different things.
I think some of it is born out of necessity. In my hometown, a small Rust Belt town, you could walk out of high school, get a job at Delphi plant and turn a screw for 35 years, make enough to raise three kids and have retirement. Those jobs don't exist anymore. So I think millennials and Generation Z, is that the next older one, have to create their own gigs. It's a gig economy. And I think we are savvy, but what's the alternative? I don't know that, particularly if you're in debt, if you have a choice. You have to create a brand. You have to create a company and meander or discover or build your way forward.
Also, one of the things that struck me, and you know, as I was doing my quick study of what are millennials, one thing is that they have to be a better group than the people who come before, if for no other reason, that they're much more diverse.
Yeah.
Right? So baby boomers, at least according to my incredible scholarship online, were something like 10% non-white. And millennials are 43% non-white in the U.S. And I was heartened by that, because I think it's fundamentally good. But then as I started to read these qualities, supposedly, you know, lazy, sheltered, privileged, entitled, I was like, wow, that doesn't actually sound like the diverse group of people that they are. It sounds like a lot of white folks being categorized. I can't imagine for, you know, all that many people of color that they feel entitled, privileged, sheltered, some obviously, perhaps, but there must be some flaw in the scholarship too, right? Because if you have this remarkably diverse group of people and a compendium of, you know, of qualities that I think radiate whiteness, we're not really capturing who the millennials are.
And I'm really excited. My son is, I refer to him as Hybrid Vigor, because his dad is Irish and I'm Mexican, and he's just this beautiful, lovely, very translucent, pale man with dark brown hair and brown eyes. And it gives me great hope that there are many children that he grew up with, very much like himself, that those families were mixed and they produced some really lovely children, and maybe it becomes less of a fixture that there has to be sameness and match, and that they bring with them a whole different perspective.
Yeah, I love to talk about that as well. I think that is so true. You know, like the one thing you look for as a child or as a student is sameness, because when you're, it's so easy to identify with people who are the same as you, for people to literally just go to the groups that they know. And for me, I can bet you that 90% of the audience here thinks that I look Indian, and why am I saying I'm South African? Well, my dad, majoritarily Indian, but grandmother European. My mom, Malaysian and South African. And for me, that represented one of the most conflicting things that I still battle with every day, because I went to a private white Anglican school in South Africa, which had about 10 students of color out of 150 in a grade. And naturally, I tended towards the 10 people of color, but the 10 people of color, the 9 people of color didn't tend towards me, because I wasn't traditionally Xhosa. I could speak the language, but I didn't represent any of the same culture. I wasn't traditionally Indian. I couldn't speak Hindi. I couldn't speak Arabic. I didn't have any of the strong Muslim tendencies that they did. And I didn't identify really with the colored people on campus as well, who, my mom is colored, but I didn't really adopt many of her characteristics. So just trying to battle that throughout high school was seriously challenging. And the one place that I found it was being a part of a society called African Relations. And I was elected chairman of the society in my high school senior year. And one of the things that that society represented to me was a place where people from all parts of Africa, so it wasn't just South Africa, it was people coming from Namibia, Tanzania, Mozambique, etc. And everyone had different cultures. So you may have had the same skin color as someone else, but you didn't have the same background. You didn't have the same beliefs. And being able to be in a room with so many different people and to share different experiences and stories was what brought us together. So it wasn't a sameness, but a sameness of sharing. And that in itself started bringing other people from the school who were of the 140 who weren't of color. And by the end of the year, we had something like 20 white students and about 40 people of color throughout the whole high school.
Do you notice a significant difference when working with millennials versus baby boomers in the workplace?
The easiest thing is technology. My first office job worked for a brilliant man, Dr. Tom Borneman at the Carter Center. Brilliant man, has been in mental health for decades, and I used to have to help him out with the computer. Not to pick on him, I mean, he's a legend in the field, but yeah, I think that's the layup is technology.
Really is. I mean, I work with an entire team of young people, and the interesting piece, age and capacity, and also that they, you know, one young guy is from Cuba, another's from Honduras, one young woman is from Mexico. So they bring some of what you're describing, which is really exciting to me, that there's not that perpetual sameness, but then the computer, I mean, really, I get a new phone, I want to throw myself out the window. So it really, we have the young guy who does our database, boy, you say, you know, could we possibly list all of the TB medications? And before I've even asked the question, he's like, sure, we can pull up, you know? So that is such a gift to be around people for whom it's not a fear-inducing activity. You know, I mean, so, yeah.
And there's always a considerable risk in, you know, generalizing or making decisions. But I venture to guess that, you know, having gone through or still be in the midst of the Me Too experience, you know, one of the remarkable things for both women and men to have appreciated in that is how long, you know, the environments of harassment or misogyny or, you know, pay discrepancy or whatever persisted, even as women both became greater forces in the workforce, rose to senior positions. You know, I at least have picked up, you know, that the younger women in the newsrooms and offices are actually far less tolerant of that, and would be much quicker to object, take action, not put up with it, which can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
Although, you know, hitting on them hasn't gone well for me.
But that's you, Joe, and there's lots of reasons there. Let me know. We'll say though, is it millennials? And just from my work experience, don't know how to write. How the heck did they get out of college? And they can't write. Now that's a gross generalization, and I'm so sorry. But that has been a piece that has made me seriously crazy. And I don't care how much technology we have, I'm not sure that writing is going to go away anytime too soon.
Yeah, I would like to add some. Add my response. So when I was back in high school, I founded the Financial Education Initiative back in Romania. And in my team, I was working with baby boomers as well. And I was the founder and the leader, and they were helping out. And I noticed the tendency to believe that the lessons of the past still apply in the present. And I think it's related to understanding the trends of technology, where the world is going and how exponentially fast we're advancing and how everything is changing, right? So I believe, and we've experienced that the lessons of the past came against us now in the present. And often some of the baby boomers used to kind of find the excuse of being experts in their fields when trying to apply the lessons of the past in the present. And I don't think that's a very good approach. And I was also reading an article these days, and they were saying that experts in a field are the least probable to innovate the field. Because they know all the problems of the field, they know the limitations. But when you come with a fresh mind, you don't know what the limitations are. So I think it would be ideal if baby boomers, again, I'm generalizing now, and they would allow a bit of space for learning and would understand the technology trends and how fast the world is.
Well, just to pick up on that, my favorite. So I spent 25 years at the New York Times, which is a great and wonderful and flawed and crazy and outrageous and heroic and pathetic institution. But I had a real kind of epiphanic moment where I was in a meeting and there was a fellow there whose father had been the executive editor at the paper in Times, so a lifelong New York Times person. And he said, "The New York Times is full of rules that don't exist." Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can see the profundity of that just washing over you. But actually, if you just stop to think, like, it's such a smart observation, and it can be such a limiting thing. So to your point, right, I mean, it's to encourage people, you know, to go ahead and break the rules that don't exist. You know, whether it's innovation or whether it's advocacy or whether it's standing up in the workplace. So.
But I think too, and I don't know if it's really more from poor people of color who've had this experience. I would think that it was true, in, you know, for women. That I remember being with my peers, sort of feeling like we needed to lock arms because what was coming at us was going to wash over us like a tsunami. And I think in the locking arms, we were not very good at breaking apart and creating space for people to come up behind us. And so it was not an intentional action. It was a defensive action that had not the results we wanted ultimately. But it came from that sense of we're joining forces, we're moving forward, we're trying to create some change in an environment that's not particularly friendly or safe, without thinking about then what you don't allow.
Go ahead. I'd like to go off on that as well. I think when you are in that environment where you are taking that defensive stance, it's so easy to just close yourself off and you forget to think about perspective, right? Because when you talking to someone, this is kind of a funny story, but so I'm from South Africa, and in South Africa during apartheid, one of the countries that really helped the anti-apartheid struggle was Cuba. Now, coming to live in the States, completely different opinion on Cuba. And the most hilarious part was that my roommate was Cuban, born in the States, and hated the Cuban government. So he had the most controversial opinions compared to me. And the first year, we didn't talk about it at all. Because, you know, we're just so, like, I'm so, like, you know, Cuba, like, helped us during the apartheid, anti-apartheid movement. Like they are actually, like, good for South Africa from my perspective. And his perspective was, like, no, like, look what they did to the people and from the U.S. perspective. And until we learned that it's not the end of the world if we have differing opinions. It's not the end of the world if we share opinions that may sound like we're trying to cause a conflict, but we won't hate each other. Like, hey, we'll argue. Hey, well, we might like fight for like a few minutes, but it's okay. And we'll have a better understanding, a better relationship at the end of the day with it. And I think when you talk about the baby boomers and the millennials, there's a huge difference in perspective. Like, and just being taking that moment to understand where someone's coming from, you don't have to agree with them. You really don't. You can disagree with them as much as you want. And you can say that to them, but listen to them. Listen to the millennial and listen to the baby boomer, and you can learn so much more.
Joe mentioned breaking rules that don't exist. Two of the biggest social movements right now are Me Too and Black Lives Matter. Those started as hashtags. Hashtags didn't exist 10 years ago. So I think there's this digital solidarity where you don't have to feel alone and isolated. You can start revolutions with a hashtag. That's something new, and I think that's something that millennials are able to harness in a really insightful way. It can go in the wrong direction, hashtag MAGA, but but it's a platform and it's a tool and it's something that's brand new and it's changing the world.
Kind of speaking to the rules that don't exist, is I think there's a big difference in the definition of family and marriage in regards to these two generations, in that if you started dating someone, you married that person, maybe for the boomers, I'm not sure. But just that perspective of marriage and the family.
Well, I had focus groups about whether or not I should have a child by myself. And selected a friend who'd been to Vietnam and felt like he could not continue the human race, at least through his own, because it had been such a horrible experience. But he reversed a 17-year-old vasectomy, and we had this gorgeous child. And he went on with his life, and he's still in touch with my son, and I went on with my life. So perhaps I'm not the best example.
No, it's totally different from generation to generation.
No, right. I'm no better. My first child we had before we got married. My second child we had when married, and now I've had twins with a woman with whom I'm not married. And you know, so I actually think it's quite a shared quality across boomers and millennials, the willingness to open yourself up to different definitions of family. And so it might be one lovely quality that we share amply.
Yeah, I'd agree. I don't know that it's necessarily a generational difference. Perhaps it's just the changing times. My sister waited until she was 39 to get married. I've had elderly friends come out as gay. I think the climate now is more accepting, whether you're a boomer or a millennial. So all lifestyles are welcome. I'm sorry?
Some political climate.
I think the point was more that, yeah. I think the point was more that it's getting better, right? Like, how many years ago was gay marriage not legal? And then another thing that I want to note is that I think millennials, I have to be careful what I say because Mara's my girlfriend. but I think millennials are scared of commitment, to be very honest.
So I want to
answer. This
is the fight we were looking for.
So I'm not sure if it's scared. I mean, not in your case, in general. I've noticed that there is a lesser desire to officialize the relationship through marriage. If you believe that the relationship is strong enough, I've noticed among millennials, they tend to think that marriage is unnecessary as long as you and the partner are confident in your relationship and you believe in each other. And some friends, or I saw this on Facebook, they were saying, why would you feel the need to involve the government and to have this all official when you just know that everything is going? So yeah, I've noticed that there is not that much of a need to officialize relationships among millennials.
Well, the woman who had my twins, I gave her an engagement ring 8 years ago, and she took it. And we're still not married.
You might be officiating at their wedding.
At my own wedding, yes. I'll get it
done. We still have a couple more minutes for questions.
Well, I mean, I think there is a lot of depth, and there is a lot of ability, and there is an ease of conversing that didn't exist when I was younger. I mean, that was my original story. I think what I'm reacting to is how education is being applied now, And that I remember when my son went to school, you know, grade 12, that we didn't care if you conjugated correctly and if your number didn't agree with your subject, oh well. And it made me insane because what they were saying is you just need to get your thoughts out, which I don't disagree with. Being able to get your thoughts out is really important. I think you need to be able to write a coherent sentence too. So I think that what we see in each sort of school generation is a reflection of what is considered the current thinking about the appropriate way to educate people. And so then what I see of myself as an older professional is that if I can help younger professionals and they're interested in this, I'm a heck of a writer and I can help with that. So I see that as my responsibility, but it has to be acceptable. I can't force it down anyone's throat, but I can say if this is something you're interested in, then this is a place where perhaps I can contribute.
And I...
what's that? The public schools?
Yeah, you know, I mean no disrespect, but I think I'm just going to push back. And some of it has to do with, right, we all live in our own little worlds and they're constrained in 100,000 different ways, whatever. If you push yourself to go out into their world a little more, there's so many good young writers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there was a young man here who, I haven't seen him this year or whatever, but I appear on a couple of poetry panels with him, whatever. I mean, a devotion to poetry for young people, mm-hmm. serious cultivation of writing and communicating. You just got to find them and find them maybe in their space. But they're there and they're super talented and super committed.
Committed.
So, you know, I feel you and I share some of the worry. But I think if you bust out a little bit of your own anxiety and worry and whatever and find them, seek them out, there's wonders there. Really, really impressive stuff.
I love that you mentioned that because I was about to say, I think it goes back to the laziness. We love to send text in emojis. I don't necessarily do this myself, full disclosure, but it's just easy to be able to send a text message to someone. And when you think about it, when we are writing, when we are wanting to put in the effort, and I think that's when the beauty comes out, that talent comes out. And I don't think it's disappeared. I think it's just been masked behind this whole image of the short text, the short responses, not wanting to be in a conversation for longer than 5 minutes.
I think a good example of our thirst for knowledge is podcasting. It's essentially a lecture. And there's podcasts that have tens of millions of downloads each month. And they can be 2 and 3 hours long, deep dives into highly intellectual topics with world experts. And millennials love them. It's taken a different form. And I agree with you. I think there are some, personally, I don't think I'm as good of a communicator writing than my aunts and uncles and parents, something I have to work on. But in terms of millennials' thirst for knowledge, I think it's either whatever's on your feed in 2 seconds or a deep dive into something you're passionate about. We're kind of, technology has freed us to not have to watch the news for 30 minutes and catch each commercial.
You still have a question? Are they particular or universal?
I don't know whether this is completely responsive, but I, you know, supposedly, anyway, millennials are less politically engaged than boomers. And when I read that, I was sort of disappointed, like, ah, I wish it was the other way around because I want to root for the millennials. Whatever. And yet, the thought that occurred to me is, who could blame them?
Right.
You know?
For the political system we put in motion.
Well, right. And maybe the, you know, I mean, it may be a radical proposition, but maybe the opting out of that is actually a position of some principle. Mm-hmm. Because how could you sell them on wanting to, you know, to get more engaged in the political process when it's as unattractive and broken and corrupt as it is? Yeah, and there's always a fine line, okay, you know, be part of the solution or whatever. But, you know, I found myself pretty hard-pressed to blame them for, mm-hmm. you know, a lack of engagement.
I want to push back on that, Joe.
Yeah.
We, those of us who grew up during the 60s, there was a lot to be pretty disgusted about, too. And we rallied together. I worry, to the previous point that was brought up, is that the way that we were educated about the system, I think we're a little bit more interested in working with, in learning about it and participating in it. And what I worry about is that there's been a lack of that orientation. And so there's what do we do? We can talk to each other. We can create social movements. But there hasn't been any engagement with the political process just yet. I think it's coming with a lot that's going on. But I think we went through it too. We reacted to it in a much different way.
Yeah, although, and again, I totally respect what you're saying, and it's a fair point. I guess and this cuts across all generations, right? If you looked at simply voter participation across generations, the boomers were no better than anybody
right.
else.
Exactly.
And so I feel your righteousness, and there's lots of value to it, but at the end of the day, it didn't actually show up in the most essential thing of the political process, which is to vote. And that is, right, that is the scandal across all generations for America, is the lack of participation in the actual act of voting.
We have one last question. We have a student skit priority, so we'll take the students. Yep.
Pick me.
Can I see the ID, please?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
We have full-time jobs as students, not to mention sometimes we have to have full-time jobs outside of being students just to pay for college. We don't have time to take up more classes to go vote sometimes. And Colorado is an amazing system. Yeah, mail-in ballots are great, but a lot of states don't do that.
No, I think it is an awesome point. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something the millennials could actually pick up and make their political issue. Like voter suppression efforts are not only
right.
directed at people of color, they are directed at
young
people.
Yep.
And, you know, the scandals in the states that have adopted, you know, very strict voter ID rules or whatever, North Carolina, Wisconsin, other states, have had a real impact on students' ability to vote. Mm-hmm. It's a huge issue. You should get out in the street.
So that's all the time that we have for this very... Thank you all for coming.